Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
Zeit Gang, you like to watch new stuff, right? I mean, who doesn't? I do. Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time, like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama, a new season of The Kardashians starring The Kardashians, of course, and Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's streaming now, and it's waiting for you on Hulu.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to season 308, episode 2 of Der Daily Zeitgeist, a production of iHeartRadio. This is a podcast where we take a deep dive into America's shared consciousness, and it is Tuesday, October 10th, 2023.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. 10-10. You know what it is? It's a lot of cake. It's
Wednesday.
National Angel Food Cake Day, which has always felt a bit light of the cake varieties. National Cake Decorating Day, National Pan Bag Day, you know, for everybody grinding out there trying to get on that Birkin life like me. World Mental Health Day, National Walk to a Park Day.
Be a character across the whole
National
the whole
Metric
episode.
Day. It's all about a grind, Jack. You know what
grind
I mean?
Because set, mindset.
The grind set mindset is what powered my grandfather to look 30 years older than he did when he was 43. You know what I mean? And that's what I'm trying to do. Like, I'm trying to grind so hard, people think I'm a time traveler. And anyway, well, you know, we're going to get into that, obviously.
Are you a mountaineer from turn of the century, West Virginia? Because you look old as hell, bro. Anyways, my name is... Look at some old pictures of mountaineers back in the day, because they would just, like, go up there without oxygen and come down looking so old. Like, it's truly the oldest looking, like, humans I've ever seen. Like, they age like presidents,
Jack,
when they're on those mountains.
Jack, that's a misnomer. They're not the oldest looking humans you've ever seen. They look like the hardest working people.
They look like the hardest grinders that I've ever seen.
Exactly. Grinding their bodies down to dust.
That's right. Well, my name's Jack O'Brien, a.k.a. In the jungle, the mighty jungle, O'Brien sleeps tonight. That is courtesy of Reedsies on the Discord. Can't be me. Can't be talking about me. Must be talking about one of my kids, because I don't sleep. I always keep one eye open. And I'm thrilled to be joined, as always, by my co-host, Mr. Miles Gray!
Hey, it's Miles Gray, a.k.a. Why don't we do birthday pie? Cake is boring, something, something, something. The a.k.a. wasn't finished, but I understand the sentiment from Scouty on Discord. Why can't we make birthday pie just a normal thing? You know what I mean?
Just do it.
And for those that do, shout out to the trailblazers out there.
Miles, we're the ones in charge of these decisions. We should just do it. As people in charge of the zeitgeist, we should just make the dang change.
Dude, I don't fucking work 300 hours a week to not make the rules. You know what I mean? And I don't even know if there are that many hours in the week, but that's what it feels like, baby.
All right. Well, thank you for calling me baby. I do love when you do that. And requested that you do that more often. Miles, in our seat, we are thrilled to be joined by a professional futurist with a PhD in the history of science. He's been a visiting scholar at Stanford and Oxford universities and is the author of 4 books, including Shorter and Rest. Please welcome to the show, Dr. Alex Soojung King Pang.
Alex! Thanks for having me, and happy National Angel Food Cake.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Are you a fan of angel food cake?
I love angel food cake.
Oh, okay,
and cake
great.
Decorating, actually. So, you know, 2 for 1.
Oh, wow. Okay. Is that like, is that a hobby of yours, decorating cakes? Or you admire the artwork?
I admire the artwork, though. Yeah. My wife and my daughter are both pretty pretty amazing bakers. So,
Okay. Well, we're so glad you joined us here today. Obviously, the listeners probably have heard me really talking about my grind set mindset.
How I get to Lambo is the thesis statement of this show.
Yeah, but as quickly as possible. You know, Tim Ferriss gave me some ideas. They aren't working very well.
Not fast enough.
I don't know
not
why.
Fast yeah. enough. I not wasn't able enough. To outsource enough of my work to enough
but yeah.
people who work for $5 an hour, unfortunately.
It didn't work that way. But we are curious to pick your mind because, yeah, it was the talk of shortened work weeks. And if that's better, I don't know, the jury's still out in my mind. We figured it's good to enlist the help of someone who has their area of expertise is in precisely that, to fight the voices that tell me to keep grinding every day and every night.
So we're mainly going off vibes on this end, and you've actually looked at data, whatever that means. So we're gonna dig into it. But before we get into that, we do like to get to know you a little bit better and ask you, what is something from your search history that is revealing about who you are or what you're up to?
Well, this morning I was on Google Translate for a while, looking at 4-day week in other languages. So it's something that I've been interested in for several years, and it's a movement that keeps growing, and I have to keep tracking it now in Turkish and Hungarian and stuff. It used to be relatively simple. It was English and maybe one or two other languages, but now it's just all over the place.
How is that spreading? Is it just kind of word of mouth that different companies are learning about it? Or is it coming usually from the workers themselves? Or how do you see that kind of happening?
Yeah, you know, a lot of it is spreading through sort of word of mouth with within industries. So, you know, you get a couple people in HR and recruiting who try it in their organizations, and then then their competitors will do it because those competitors are starting to lose people to the company that did it first. And then, it gets written up in the news, and there's some ambitious politician who thinks, this is how they become, governor or senator or something, right? Championing the 4-day week. And so, and it kind of builds from there. And it's fortunately been something that's gotten, plenty of press and plenty of attention. And so it's been really great to see it acquire that kind of momentum and take on a life of its own.
Yeah.
Is there anything to you think, are there certain cultures where innately some cultures are going to be a little bit harder for them to cross the barrier into the 4-hour work week, just based on sort of ideas of what productivity or what, someone's worth is based on work? Or is there also a thing where humanity is just kind of naturally maybe progressing towards this, where culture or not, this feels better, this works better?
Yeah, I think if you got 24 hours in a day, you're gonna value this. So, I have seen this in two of the hotspots for the 4-day week are Japan and Korea, which are both countries whose languages have their own words for working yourself to death. It's not just Sweden and Denmark and places with really good work-life balance. You actually see it most in places that have really serious issues with stress, overwork, etc.
Okay.
Yeah, it's definitely
I haven't hit that yet.
Yeah, we're not on board yet. But
you said 24 hours in a day, my man.
Yeah, exactly.
You got to find some more hours.
That's right.
I got 30 in a day over here. But anyway, go on. That's another story.
It does cut against the standard narrative that we see in the mainstream media. I feel that's one of the things that made it jump out to me is this wouldn't be getting coverage unless it actually worked, because so much of the mainstream narrative is focused on emphasizing the impact of these billionaires and how they worked so hard and did it all by themselves and bootstrapped their way up. And so to have this thing that keeps getting media attention that feels really counter to the logic that is the software that the entire media that we consume runs on, that's one of the things that made me be I feel there's must be something here, because if it wasn't true, the media wouldn't allow it, you know?
Yeah, like weapons of mass destruction. We were saying right. that too. Yeah. Like, why would they talk about that? The yellow cake.
That's right.
It's got to be true.
What is something you think is overrated?
So what do I think is overrated? You know, I think overwork is actually overrated. That, you know, there is a century's worth of research that tells us that that is counterproductive, both for people and for organizations. And that, you know, humans are able to sustain brief periods of, you know, bursts of work for short periods of time, right? You know, sort of running away from the tiger or harvesting crops in the fall. But the idea that you do this sort of as a way of life turns out to sort of lead to bad outcomes in all kinds of industries. And, you know, industrial like engineers and or of sociologists started seeing this as early as like 1905, 1908 in the optics industry, right? High performing industries and like explosive and munitions industries during World War I. And it's just taken us a really long time to take that data seriously. But I think we're finally at a point where it is getting a sympathetic hearing. So
what did they find? What did those industries see that people like kept, that just accidents were happening when they were overworking people? Or
yeah, so you get more accidents, which in a munitions factory when you're dealing with explosives is not a good thing. But mm-hmm. you know, more generally, you get higher rates of mistakes. You see people overlooking small things that maybe signal big problems down the line. So, you know, out of a few years ago, Samsung had an issue with one of its cell phones with the batteries exploding. And this is like one in a million odds of it happening. But when you sell several hundred million of these things, you got a class action suit. And one of the things they found was that the engineers who are working on this were working like 80-hour weeks, literally sleeping under their desks. And they had some data that suggested that this was sort of potentially a problem, but they were so rushed and basically so exhausted that nobody followed up on it. And yeah. So, you know, I think it's, and, you know, today when you've got incredibly complicated technologies, amazingly sophisticated products, that kind of really tiny problem actually can have gigantic consequences now.
Right.
And then, you know, people also are more likely to get sick, to just up and quit. They're also more likely to cut corners and cheat when sort of they're overworked and tired. So, you know, not a good look, like if you're, you know, a sort of investment bank or a law firm or something. And so, you know, for all of these reasons, it turns out it's not good for people and it's not good for companies.
So what I'm hearing is they work hard or work smart, not hard, and that you're basically a hater on the grind set.
You know,
would be my definition of what you just said.
Is it okay if we just come out and say that you might be a hater against the grind set mindset?
You know, I will also add the odds of crashing your Lambo go up a lot when you're sleep deprived. Yeah. So, you know, until they come out with a self-driving version, then, you know, this may be something to consider.
I mean,
that's cool though, dude. I'll just throw another 300 hours on and get me another Lambo. That's the thing. That's how easy it is. You know what I mean? I think that's like the mindset some people have. It's too scarce. There aren't enough Lambos out there. There are enough Lambos out there. It's not enough hours in the day. And that's what we're all in search of. You know what I mean?
I mean, should we just, like, with all the slander against Grindset, should we just run through our schedule real quick and see if...
Yeah, maybe. You know, yeah,
Dr.
I mean,
Penn
yeah,
can find anything wrong with, yeah, him, like if he spots any problems. So, all right. I mean, I don't know about you, Miles. I wake up at 2 a.m. Before Mark Wahlberg, before The Rock.
Okay.
I fuel my workout by thinking about all my enemies still sleeping in their beds.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And laugh to myself so loud that it wakes people that I share a house with, because they're, you know, it's just funny to me.
Yeah.
They're sleeping while I'm
eating
out here.
Your dust.
Yeah, exactly. They're sleeping and inhaling a bunch of dust is what's happening to mm-hmm. them. How about you? When do you wake up?
I wake up, you know, to be honest, you said you wake up at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Oh man, and this
every
is kind of this is a,
every day.
This is humiliating for me because we always live comparatively, as we've both realized that's the healthiest way to live is to compare your situation to another
drive
each other towards total dissatisfaction with our lives. And so I wake up at 3:45 actually.
Wow.
Yeah. So don't judge.
I mean,
but then no, yeah, and I work out till 5, shower, drink 2 pots of coffee. Then 5:30, I begin working, reading the news, writing. Then at 10 to 3, back to work, doing the real work. Yeah, that's like back recording the show, taking meetings, doing development stuff, things like that.
So you're working, but then the next thing on your schedule is back to work.
Yep, exactly. Well, the real work, obviously. Then 3 p.m., I obviously take a second to be a parent. I look at my infant son on the monitor for about 15, 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. Then I go back to work again. Then 5:30, have a light breakfast. 6 to 9 p.m., look through used Lambo listings to see what's out there. 9 p.m., I eat a lunch of whatever my wife and son have left over from their quote-unquote dinner.
Yes. Do you also go in after they leave? Because I've noticed that sometimes that creates friction. Like when I go in and they're still there, it creates friction and it slows me down a little bit.
I look through the doorway and I giggle to myself and I go, well, that's why y'all are unemployed. Right. And I get back to it. Then again, 9:15 to 12 a.m. leisure time. I do take some time out for myself. That's where I watch American Psycho on VHS. But I'm trying to learn every single line word for word. Mm-hmm. That's what I do in my leisure time. Then 12 a.m. time for dinner, where I just go for a run in the park where I'm usually looking for sleeping squirrels to eat. And then at 2 a.m. I go to bed. Do it all over again. I'm sorry. And I cut you off. So you're up at 2.
Up at 2. So by the time you wake up, unfortunately, my man, I am already out the door on my way to the hospital because I'm generally like unable to see very well when I wake up that early because my eyes are like half closed, and so I will often run into things, and at 3:45 I'm just so tired I can't remember if I've like done that already that day or if it was the day before or like a month ago. So I just like to check in with urgent care just to be like, everything look okay here? Do I have any major holes in my body? Yeah, but other than that, it's like a lot of the same stuff. 5:15, I add in a little, give my reflection in the mirror, the get to work fat boy speech. But then I'm just grinding. Mm-hmm. 8:30, I will usually come to in a parking garage or grocery store loading bay somewhere within a 12-mile radius of my office. I'm working on my speed so I can get that radius up. But then, just kind of use context clues to figure out how I got there and why I'm talking to the person I'm talking to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, midnight, say goodnight to each individual picture of Lambo and influencer on my vision board. 1:35 a.m., fall asleep standing up like a horse. Right, does that sound like, what are we thinking there? Do you think that is overwork? Would you call that overwork?
That's a good work-life balance, no, Alex?
I got to say, first of all, I really admire sort of the combination of sort of Genghis Khan, Elon Musk, and the Joker that you've managed to sort of achieve here.
God. You listen to the show, right? Because we always start off, that's our triune God, Genghis Khan, Elon Musk, and the Joker. In the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit.
That's right.
I might have a couple ideas, around the edges about maybe expanding the amount of sleep that sort of, and there's some good science behind why
we'll
getting get more than, let's say, 20 or 30 minutes of sleep per day is a good thing. the other thing I might, recommend is that there might be a little bit more room for sort of some breaks, some non Lambo and influencer related activity.
Okay.
Yeah.
Though, I will say, looking back at my book, I studied a lot of historical sort of figures who really were around before the founding of the Lamborghini company. So, we can't say that today, would Charles Darwin, not be going for a Lambo? who knows?
Yeah. But, you because, know, like, gotta... so here's the thing. I don't get the Lambo for the brakes. I get it for the gas. All gas, right. No brakes is how I live my life.
Exactly.
So, like a Lambo. So, that's the thing that I feel like Darwin kind of wouldn't have been able to wrap his mind around necessarily. Yeah.
Survival of the grindest is what he actually would have, you know, right. I came up with that concept, but that's neither here nor there.
So there stupid. Well, thank you so much for bearing with us and for looking at our schedules with us.
Yeah.
What is something that you think is underrated?
Let's pick up on where we were just a second ago. And I think, you know, actually sleep is underrated. Despite, you know, sort of the like internet mattress companies and things that are sort of, you know, that are sponsoring lots of podcasts, maybe like yours. I don't know. But,
there's it's been a while, you know, so no.
Okay.
Yeah, it's but, fine. Feel free to talk cash shit with sponsored us in a while.
You know, Peter Attia, who wrote a sort of terrific book that's actually sort of behind me about called Unaging, which is all about how sort of the, you know, all the amazing things you can do in order sort of to have a great long life, talks about sleep as one of like the great secret weapons in in our arsenal, and that it does, you know, it does amazing stuff for brains, for bodies. It even does really good stuff, you know, for us creatively, and helps us, you know, it sort of helps us have better ideas and have better, more sustainable lives. So, and the problem is we underestimate sleep at our peril, but everybody does it, right? Nobody ever says, I'll work when I'm dead, but, you know, sort of, we do say, I'll sleep when I'm dead, which is, which I think, just illustrates the way that we value the one, you know, the one over the other. So,
right.
That's I never sleep because sleep is the cousin of death.
Cousin of death. Yeah. Yes, that's because we're in a New York state of mind. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned like the word obliquity, mm-hmm. which I had not really heard, but like that kind of, it's an idea that I've been kind of dancing around and like talking about this show and talking about like people coming to like having scientific breakthroughs in their dreams, or, you know, that they're just being these unconscious forces in our lives that kind of break through and like guide us in a direction that we might not be even consciously aware of. And just this idea that there's so much work happening at an unconscious level. And that's what it seems like a lot of the value of rest and, you know, not being on task all the time, to quote my other philosophical hero, Jeff Bezos, you know, mm-hmm. some off task time can actually make you much better at solving problems. Right.
Yeah.
And there is this anecdote that I'd never heard before, but about like how studies of the brain have found that the brain is using up as much, like when I'm staring off into space, you know, sitting at my desk and just like, I'm like, all right, my brain needs a rest. I'm looking off into space in the middle distance with my mouth open, like that time my brain is using just as much oxygen as it does when I'm working on a problem. Right.
Yeah.
And it's like, but my brain prefers or like craves that rest. Can you talk about that and like why you think it craves that?
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, first off, absolutely correct that sort of our brains, when we are apparently just spacing out, right, are actually not slowing down or shutting off. They're just as active as they are when we are trying to do our taxes or, you know, or sort of talk our kids out of.
Oh my God. Wait, hold on. You do your taxes.
So, you know, sort of sending.
Hey, we're gonna pick and choose here, Miles, because there's some bad habits he's talking about.
That's Lambo money you're giving away, Alex. Yeah, all right, we'll go on.
But you know, it turns out, you know, even when we're like sort of thinking of nothing at all, or you know, sort of daydreaming, that there's a lot going on, you know, under the hood, as it were. And what scientists have found is that there are basically parts of our brain that switch on when we're mind wandering, as they call it. And these are parts that are associated with creative thinking, with thinking about the future, sort of, it's often sort of the more visual parts of our or brains. And that default mode network, as scientists sort of call it, does two things. Number one, it switches on really, really quickly. Like in the time it takes us to blink your eyes, the default mode can be seen kind of firing up. And the second thing is the default mode is really good at attacking problems that you've been working on but haven't solved yet. So when you, you're trying to remember, you know, the name of the actor who is in the movie and that other thing, and sort of it doesn't come to mind, you know, you can't remember it. And then 5 minutes later, sort of you're doing something else and all of a sudden the name pops into your head, right? It's Hugh Jackman or whoever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's
never, the default I would never forget mode. Hugh Jackman's name, but go ahead.
Okay. You know, right. But that's the default mode working on something even while your attention is moved elsewhere. And one of the things I think that really creative people are good at is recognizing just how powerful the default mode can be, especially if you give it some time, some regular time sort of in your day to do its thing. And so, you know, not only do you have time for rest and recovery, but you get this kind of extra time when sort of your creative subconscious is able to take on problems that you haven't been able to solve just by grinding away at them and find, you know, hacks and shortcuts and so forth, and find solutions that, you know, that you haven't been able to find through sort of conscious effort, but are down there in your brain somewhere, and it can kind of bring them to the surface for you.
Yeah. Now, we have to take a break, but before we do, just one thing I picked up from what you were just saying is that it sounds like you're having trouble remembering Hugh Jackman's name. And a helpful little trick is think huge jacked man, and then picture him from Wolverine. And it like does, it's like a little mind palace thing.
Huh.
But there's also interesting other interesting stuff in there. Let's take a quick break and we'll come back because I want to hear you talk specifically, you know, about your background as a historian of science and kind of how that led you to where you are today. So we'll be right back.
You like to watch new stuff, right, Zygang? I know I do. Well, go to Hulu and see what's new. Because Hulu has new stuff all the time, like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump. Join Lisa and her hand-selected staff at Chateau Rosabelle, a glamorous estate in the French countryside, as they live, work, and play together 24/7. Vanderpump Villa is where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. And don't miss the new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course, and Season 5 promises new horizons for the entire Kardashian clan, and if you're looking for steamy streams, check out Grand Cayman Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set on the tropical Caribbean island of Grand Cayman, where the rich come to play. But be warned, it's a small island, and secrets don't stay secret for long. So come check out what's new on Hulu this month. It's streaming now, and it's waiting for you on Hulu.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. Now, this is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. If you ever felt like you were always too much this while also never being enough that, this is the podcast for you. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more via my own personal stories, along with interviews with inspiring thought leaders from our community. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community that you need to know. So much of what makes our community so beautiful is our diversity, yet too often those of us who don't fit into this dumb stereotypical box of whatever it means to be Latino are left without a voice or just forgotten about. On this show, I celebrate the uniqueness of our culture and invite you to walk in your authenticity. Listen to Life as a Gringo as a part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. And yeah, so you started as a historian of science, and I've heard you talk about like what you learned from Darwin, and you know, Ernst Mach talked about kind of these ideas of, you know, letting the subconscious take its turn. But can you just talk about like just looking at the historical record around these great thinkers and what they knew?
Right. So, you know, part of the reason that I talk about these folks in REST is, number one, their lives are really, really well documented, right?
Right.
There were 14,000 letters in sort of the Darwin Archive at Cambridge University. So we actually know an awful lot about their daily lives. We also have enough perspective so that we can, you know, say with a pretty high degree of confidence, Charles Darwin was an important person who made an enduring contribution to our understanding of the natural world. Yeah. And, you know, finally, in contrast to today's great, so many of today's great achievers, they don't, you know, we can see them without the filter of like PR handlers and sort of, you know, people who are worried about their stock price, sort of making the argument that, you know, these people actually sort of never rest. They're always serving the customer, creating delightful products, blah, blah, blah. And so we have actually a better understanding of how they worked and how they did their work than we do of many inventors and entrepreneurs today.
I don't know, that little fish with feet that Darwin came up with was pretty sick marketing, I gotta say. That branding is pretty tight. He's kind of a marketing genius.
Yeah. He did have his moments. You know, it's just too bad that he was working before there was actually any, you know, social media. But
yeah,
you know,
I've always thought of him more as an influencer than anything. But yeah, okay. I think he did other important stuff.
He definitely had a lot of influence. No question about that.
Yeah.
And the other thing you see when you look at these lives is there's an amazing consistency in things like their daily schedules and sort of when they worked, when they took breaks, and how they kind of layered these periods of really focused work of only like 90 minutes to 2 hours. And then a break, and then another deep dive, what Cal Newport calls deep work. And you do that like three times a day. And that's about all they needed in order to, you know, come up with ideas that sort of changed the world. And I think that's a great challenge to the assumption that in order to do, you know, world-changing stuff, we have to work enormously long hours. We have to, in effect, sacrifice ourselves and our happiness and our health and sometimes our families in, you know, sort of to make, you know, sort of to reach some mountaintop, make a discovery, you know, et cetera. And that it's possible to have, you know, long lives that are longer, that are more sustainable, but also still let us do really amazing work that lets us express our passions and that sort of is deeply satisfying for a really long time. So that ultimately is, you know, what Darwin taught me, along with the fish with the feet.
Yeah. Which is, I've got a ton of those in my garage trying to get rid of, if you want to buy some.
Yeah. That is kind of the whole point of this episode, is actually trying to help Miles move that product, because he is underwater on those things, man.
I shouldn't have made it in pure gold. I think that's where I went wrong.
Shouldn't have made it in pure gold.
Yeah. But what do you think? Like, so I, you know, from my, we talk about culturally, right? Like how some places work themselves to death. I know that from, like, I have a Japanese family who, when I first like was working in media, they thought my job was not serious because I wasn't like working day and night. What was sort of the evolution of being able to be like, I don't know, Darwin works like a couple hours a day, to sort of this like new, like the exaltation of like the nonstop working person, and that is why they are successful. How did we like what jumps did we make? I'm assuming the industrial age had a lot to do with that, but where were we and where are we now, essentially?
It did have a lot to do with it, but even, you know, 100 years ago, there was this sense that, you know, super successful people have kind of earned the right to leisure because of their success. You know, not that getting rich meant that you had to never, ever stop. Like, if you look at old issues of Forbes magazine from the 1910s, 1920s, right? Forbes magazine has never been one that's been especially critical of capitalists. But, right. You know, lots of those profiles have stuff about how these guys spend, like, you know, still go to Minnesota to tramp in the woods where they grew up before, you know, sort of coming back to Wall Street and, you know, sort of, you know, and sort of cornering the silver market. I think, you know, so, you know, part, but what happened to change that, I think, really starts like in the 70s and 80s, when you have sort of the realignment of the American economy. You have sort of the, or along with the growth of the computer industry, or the high tech industry, and finance simultaneously, both of which teach us that the way to be successful now is not to start at the bottom, pay your dues, and work your way up, right? The age in which both General Electric and General Motors could be run by guys named Charlie Wilson, both of whom started in the mailrooms of their companies, was now over, right? The way you became rich was to be like Steve Jobs, right? Or to have overnight success, or like, you know, Charlie Sheen in Wall Street. And that becomes the model for what a successful career looks like, in a sense, sort of you get rich before the next, you know, either before your technical skills become obsolete, before the next turn of Moore's Law means that someone else has a chance at bat, or, you know, sort of the next, sort of the, you know, the next stage in the global economy or economic turndown, or of, you know, wipes everybody out. And then, you know, other structural factors like sort of the growth of, or of increasing reliance on sort of temporary labor, stalling of wages, and culturally, I think the sensibility that, you know, work goes from something that is important in every American's life to essentially the only thing, right? More important than family, than community, than religion. It means that it is like the undisputed champion of everybody's existence. And so, you know, all of that stuff together means that it's been really hard to push back against all of that and to imagine an alternative. And it's taken something as dramatic as the pandemic, right, to sort of shift, to make a lot of us shift gears to see that actually, you know, all these things that we took for granted that we thought were like inevitable and inescapable turn out to be things that we can change. And to begin to take seriously the possibility that we can actually, you know, sort of rather than have our workplaces changed by a virus, make these changes ourselves for the better. But, you know, that's a brief history of how we got in here and how we're getting out.
It's interesting to me that it happened in like the 70s and 80s at a time when like people started really like hoarding and getting immoral amounts of wealth for like doing things that like building things that weren't lasting, or, you know, doing
corporate raiding and stuff.
Yeah,
like
corporate
that.
Raiding. Mm-hmm. Like, it reminds me of the anecdote from the People's History of the United States where like the War Department changes its name to the Department of Defense at the moment that they start waging non-defensive wars because right. they're like, they need this, you know, linguistic defense mechanism to like throw people's attention away. And it's like the powers that be in capitalism need this idea that like, well, you just have to work harder. You just outwork everyone to justify that they're actually not doing anything that is harder or more worthwhile, and certainly not millions of times more important than the people who they're out earning by a factor of a million.
You know, Jack, that points to another important thing, which is that, you know, we've come to see of both success and challenges in the workplace as totally like sort of individual and personal. Right. Sort of my success is because I worked enormously long hours, not because I have a social network, I have patrons, friends, you know, right. et cetera. Right. And if I have a, you know, sort of if I have a problem at work, or if I want to be more successful, sort of the, you know, the key is all in what I myself do. Right. Get up earlier, hustle harder, et cetera. And I think that we've, you know, sort of even those of us who turn out whose clocks have 30 hours in a day,
thank you,
discover that, you know, at some point you run out of hours, and the ability, you know, the ability to solve problems that way hits a limit. And the fact that we all share, that we all have these kinds of problems, suggests that actually maybe a more powerful and enduring way to deal with them would be to solve them together, right? To act collectively. And that's one of the big things behind stuff like sort of the 4-day week, is that, you know, it's something that's done in companies where everybody does it, from the CEO or of, you know, CEO on down. And yeah. I think part of the success of the movement has been that it has, you know, it has shown us that, shown us the power of collective action to change how we work and to make work better for us all.
Yeah. That just made me think of the fact that Zach Morris is the ultimate capitalist, because
he can freeze time.
He can freeze time. Yeah. And that
Saved by the Bell reference.
Saved by the Bell. Yeah, of course. I don't think I have to explain that to anybody here, but I'm sure this comes up all the time in academic circles. But that was a fantasy. That was like a thing that I was, when I was younger, I was like, oh man, to be able to freeze time, you have like so much extra time. I could like get so good at things, or like do all my work and then just like come back. And it's really, you know, living my life on Zach Morris's clock, you know?
How, like, I'm curious to see, like, you know, when talking about...
I got a lot
about,
more on Zach Morris here, Miles,
I was actually about to talk about the Zach Morris when he had to take two people to the same dance, and how he really could have been. Jack, let me finish the question.
Okay, my bad.
No, but Alex, like, we talk a lot about on the show just sort of the just terrible habit we have, especially in America and other like Western capitalist societies, of just like, it's all about work. Productivity is the only metric to define your life. And like, you know, we see that obviously like in a more professional level, but I feel like it's also really difficult for people who like have like, you know, hourly wage working jobs and things like that. What is the sort of same way? Because obviously I feel like when people go, like, I'm sure if you tell a business owner, it's like, oh, 4 weeks, what, for all my productivity to go down? How do those sort of lessons apply to various industries? Because I can easily see how, like, in a professional thing, it's like, well, we've got all these like invoices we have to process as an accounting firm or whatever. Once you're done, then you have something there. But like, for something that's like sort of like an always on business, like retail consumer sort of facing business, what is the same way? What is the way that needs to be messaged to those people for them to not think, well, my line will go down if this happens? And how does this sort of vision offer a new sort of form of, I guess, you know, time liberation for workers that are like in every sector?
Right. So, okay, first of all, I think that the 4-day week is something that the very, you know, whose very earliest adopters tended more to be in like professional and creative services. And partly because that work is kind of more malleable or more shapeable by individuals. It also tends to be a little more project based. And so,
right.
And you know, you're not like actually moving physical things around. So sort of easier to imagine how to redesign it. But one of the really interesting things is that we've seen is it move into places like nursing. And I'm actually working with a police department that's moving, that is experimenting with 32-hour work weeks for officers. You know, and talk about two industries where you don't want, you know, sleep deprived or of overworked people coming in and making mistakes is like in an ICU and, you know, sort of during any interaction with sort of with law enforcement. And what we found there is that, you know, okay, a couple things. Number one, that kind of work turns out to be just as creative as what we think of as, you know, creative work of like people sitting around in meetings, you know, drawing on whiteboards. It's just, we don't recognize it as such, right? There's just as much ingenuity or of problem-solving skill, et cetera, required to either defuse a situation, to, you know, assess what's going on in an emergency room, to calm down people. And so this kind of work is just as responsive to the benefits of a shorter work week on the part of individuals. Now, the way that organizations make it work is for nurses, you know, like places like nursing homes, they have huge issues around sort of turnover and sort of recruitment and retention, right? These often are jobs that are not very well paid. They're highly stressful. And so, you know, it's easy for people to come into those jobs, work, you know, for maybe a year or two, and even if they like it, to find the stresses, you know, sort of are too much and for them to leave. Moving to a shorter work week means that they have more time for recovery. So more time to, you know, and that, but also it means that the organizations themselves, like nursing homes that have moved to 6-hour shifts, while still paying people the same amount of money that they were paying for 8-hour shifts, they save enough in temp agency fees. You know, when someone calls in sick, you got to get someone from a temp agency, and it's like 5 times as expensive per hour as to or of you know have right. the regular full time person. You save so much money on that that the programs pay for themselves, and you get higher quality of care. So less administration of psychotropic drugs, fewer like bed sores, slips and falls, all the kinds of things that indicate whether nursing home residents or people in a hospital are being well cared for. And yeah. So, you know, in a sense, basically, there are industries in which there are hidden costs to overwork and high turnover that a 4-day week are subsidized by. We're seeing that in the restaurant industry, in healthcare, the trial with the police force. It's an 80-person force, and they've saved something like $200,000 in overtime, which is like incredible in like the last, you know, 4 months or so that they've been doing it. And so, you know, it's not just that, you know, these are jobs that, you know, in which individuals benefit, but it turns out that once you dive into the numbers, there often are kind of systemic savings that justify moving from eight-hour shifts to or to shorter ones. So, you know, even when you have to pay more people, you have to hire more staff, it's, you know, the numbers still work out. And then with retail, the most interesting thing I'm seeing has been or of places that will stay open now for 12 hours and have 2 6-hour shifts. So that means that you get more walk-in, you know, you get more walk-ins. People can, you know, come into the store or the garage before work, you know, maybe get some work done or before they've got to, you know, drop the kids off. And it means that, you know, for, you know, you get more customers and more revenue. And so even if you have to hire sort of 1 or 2 more people, it often can pay for itself that way, as sort of right. on more sales.
Yeah,
it's wild to think about the creative work that police do. That's crazy because every time I'm pulled over, they're like, "Why are you in this? Why are you in this neighborhood?" Because they're coming up with like really interesting reasons why I shouldn't be there. But
in
I
their
see
mind,
now
yeah, they have
that
some
it's an
theories.
Exhaustion issue. I'm like, dude, just get some rest.
Yeah, hey buddy, maybe you could. You need a nap. officer, sir, you seem so sleepy. You seem so sleepy.
Go to bed. Shh. But no, it is like, is there potentially any, like, this could apply to any job, right? Like, is there, like, in when looking at sort of the way we toil and labor, is there any job where you're like, okay, maybe that one has to kind of stay that way? It seems, I don't know, from my perspective, I'm like, I think this applies to everything, right? Can we just call it a day? Everyone goes to 4 days?
I think, you know, looking at it economically, I think if you commute to work by helicopter, it's going to be hard to move to a 4 day week. So like if you're working on an oil rig or something, right? It's like 10 days on, 10 days off. Just the cost of getting to work and back is such that a 4 day week is probably not going to work very well. And then after that, it really becomes a matter of like a professional ideology.
Right. Yeah.
Hedge funds are not going to do it because they have constructed incredibly profitable systems for hiring 22-year-olds, working them to death, and then discarding the desiccated husks 3 years later and hiring new kids, right?
Right.
So until their, you know, Viking freezers are full of Wagyu beef in their, like, apocalypse bunkers, they're not going to have a lot of
incentive. Oh, you're looking at my vision board?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, sort of. But there were, you know, and then places like law and medicine, you know, they pride themselves on being able to work these kinds of titanically long hours. And even though they recognize that there are high costs to it and it leads to sort of instability for organizations and unnecessary burnout, until now, it's been hard to envision constructing something different. There definitely are older people in these fields who really resist the idea that you can, you know, sort of you can scale back hours and make the work better without making the work worse.
Right.
You know, occasionally you get people who say, I can't do this because, look, I don't have another life other than reading SEC filings or, you know, x-rays. So don't ask me to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's take one more break. And then I have another thing that I heard you say that kind of made the whole thing fall into place for me. So we'll be right back.
You like to watch new stuff, right, Zygang? I know I do. Well, go to Hulu and see what's new. Because Hulu has new stuff all the time, like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump. Join Lisa and her hand-selected staff at Chateau Rosabelle, a glamorous estate in the French countryside, as they live, work, and play together 24/7. Vanderpump Villa is where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. And don't miss the new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And season 5 promises new horizons for the entire Kardashian clan. And if you're looking for steamy streams, check out Grand Cayman Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set on the tropical Caribbean island of Grand Cayman, where the rich come to play. But be warned, it's a small island, and secrets don't stay secret for long. So come check out what's new on Hulu this month. It's streaming now, and it's waiting for you on Hulu.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season 1, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season 1, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. Now, this is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. If you ever felt like you were always too much this while also never being enough that, this is the podcast for you. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more via my own personal stories, along with interviews with inspiring thought leaders from our community. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community that you need to know. So much of what makes our community so beautiful is our diversity, yet too often those of us who don't fit into this dumb stereotypical box of whatever it means to be Latino are left without a voice or just forgotten about. On this show, I celebrate the uniqueness of our culture and invite you to walk in your authenticity. Listen to Life as a Gringo as a part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. I was just telling these guys I once came to out of one of my sleep fugues while flying one of those oil rig helicopters. And
yeah,
I didn't even know how to fly a helicopter. I didn't think, but I think I was just learning at an incredible rate.
It's called grinded, man. Yeah,
that's right. But so I heard you interviewed where the host, I think it was 10% happier. The host was like, so, but you're asking them to do the same amount of work in less time. Like, how does that not cause problems? And you responded with the thing that makes this whole thing make sense to me, that the idea that when you're a worker and you get to keep the dividends of your efficiency as the worker in this case. Like in the past, when you had workers doing their job more efficiently and just the overall goal, the overall idea was that they had to work 40 hours a week. If they did their job more efficiently, capital kept the dividends of that efficient work. They would just give you more work to do. So if I figure out how to make 8 baskets in 4 days, and it used to be take me 5 days, in the traditional version of things, now my company asks me to make 10 baskets. They're just like, well, now you make 2 baskets a day, buddy. You
but
just
I did
fucked
the 8.
Up. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, you just no, fucked no, yourself fast. By right. learning to do that. So like the incentive structure is all off. And so, you know, in that case, I would probably keep it a secret or like build in efficiencies into my schedule so that I could, you know, kill time at work unless there was like some sort of structure attached to it. But even then, like working longer and faster and more intensely, like I might not share that information with my fellow workers. I might try and, you know, or only apply it when like the incentive structure was set up in the right way. But like in a 4-day work week, you figure out how to make 8 baskets. You get to keep the dividend of that efficiency by getting a day off to, you know, chill or do what you want. And also you don't have to like keep it a secret. It's just the like arbitrariness of that 5-day work week is like what gets in the way, like just being like, you have to fill the 40 hours. Also, something that like I came across just in researching the 5-day or 4-day work week is the idea that like just the 7-day week is also arbitrary. Like years, days, months all correspond to physical events happening to our planet. And the week is just kind of made up. So like the idea that like, oh no, we have to fill 5/7 of this 7-day week is kind of bullshit. But yeah, that idea that like this allows you to like keep the dividends of your job, of like your efficiency and make your life better. Like that started, that was kind of the key detail I needed to make this whole thing make sense to me. Is that, does that help you kind of understand what's going on? And is that sort of the dynamic that you see going on when you see these programs working?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that the one of the big ideas that we work with companies and work with leadership to sort of to understand is that the 4-day week is not just, you know, it's not a concession that companies are simply making to their workforces, but rather the 4-day week is something that everybody is creating together, right? By finding efficiencies, by making meetings shorter, by doing other things in order to use technology smarter or give people more focus time. Sort of, you are, in effect, creating time that that the creators are able to reclaim for themselves. And that's incredibly powerful for two reasons, right? First of all, it's a tremendously short feedback loop between what you're doing and what you get, right? It's not like, sort of, you're working harder, therefore, sort of, your retirement account is X percent bigger and you will appreciate that 40 years from now. It is, we've done these things together and therefore we can go home at the end of the day on Thursday and have a 3-day weekend. Sort of, so, you know, that's a very, very immediate, tangible reward. The right. Second thing I think that's important is the sort of collective aspect to it, right? That everybody works together in order to make this happen. One of the classic moves in, you know, sort of labor relations is, or management labor relations is, you know, offering the new guy on the factory line or the machine tool, you know, or the machine tool shop, sort of, more money if they can work faster. And the struggle always is traditionally, sort of, wage incentives can be used as a way of breaking labor solidarity and forcing a ratcheting up of output at the expense of workers. And, you know, one of the things that skilled laborers, part of their power is an ability collectively to push back against increases in, you know, demands in increased productivity. And in a sense, the 4-day week takes the kind of vision of collective action of efficiency and flips it around so that you are working together and you have a great incentive to share, you know, to share those greater efficiencies, to share ways of working smarter, but not in a way that benefits me, but comes at your expense, but helps all of us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it does mean that companies, you know, have to sort of, the one big thing they've got to, they have to get their, you know, get their heads around is you don't, you know, let people figure all this stuff out. And then at the end of the trial say, you know, it's awesome you figured out how to do all this work in 4 days. Now let's go back to 5 and you can just produce 20% more for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine we took that and did that 5 days a week. Like, right. Oh, what the fuck is that?
Fortunately, it has not happened. And,
right.
You know, not with any of the companies that sort of that 4-day week Global has worked with. And I think partly, number one, everybody recognizes that this is the fastest way to getting your sort of your business burned down and any jury saying, yeah, that's okay. The perpetrators were acting out of a sense of justice. But also, you know, the bosses get a 4-day week too. And for all of our, you know, indignation at capitalism, it is a fact that, you know, particularly entrepreneurs and people in executive roles do have really high levels of stress, burnout, drug dependency, sort of, et cetera, all of which signals that they benefit just as much from a 4-day week as everybody else. And so when after 6 months of having a 4-day work week, most CEOs are willing to say, you know, actually, this is kind of saving my life and I'm not as much of a heart attack risk. And I remember the names of my children and that, you know, and my wife recognizes me. And maybe
the dream. You know,
maybe I can live with that.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Is it sort of, do a lot of CEOs, because obviously that's the neck that turns the head in most instances in an organization. Does it take them to, like, they can't just understand it intellectually when this is described to them? It's sort of like, I have to experience it and then I can come around because it's too abstract. Or do some people, when told about, like, the efficiencies and how beneficial it is, not just for the business, but also the workers and employees, that they're able to turn around? Like, what Because I feel like that's the one thing that's probably keeping so many companies from doing this. You're like, ah, that's a bunch of hippie crap or whatever they think it is. It's like, I'm gonna work till I die. And also, I work hard so I can afford to do the drugs that I do. I do the good ones. That's how
work
I
hard,
justify.
So I can afford more Coke. So I can do more Coke. Right. So I can work harder. Like, not, so I could do more Coke.
Adderall,
so I can afford more Coke.
Yeah.
You know, you raise a terrific point, which is that, you know, first of all, almost every company, there is some senior person who is championing this. Very often, you know, in startups, it's the founder or like founding team who have themselves spent like 10 or 15 years doing 70, 80 hour weeks. And they're realizing, you know, they've got kids now, they're getting a little older, and they're wondering, how much longer can I keep this up? And then I think that they very often are sort of are leading the charge within their organizations. And then in terms of, you know, can you just look at the numbers or do you have to feel it? You got to feel it. And I think that, you know, sort of one of the pieces of advice that we give to, let's say, people who are not at the executive level about how to sell this, sort of, you know, sell it upwards, is the numbers are good, but they're not the thing that really sort of gets people over the line. What gets people over the line is a vision of how their lives and how everybody's life could be different and could be better if the CEO is willing to take the lead on this. It's a little bit like One Last Job movies, which I absolutely love, right?
Yeah.
You know, you've always got The Rock or Nick Cage or someone, you got to steal 50 cars before, you know, in 24 hours, or they're going to kill your brother.
Yeah.
And one of the things, you know, and it's a huge goal, but in these movies, you never do it by yourself, right? The first thing you do is you assemble your team, you know, you have your sort of driver and your hacker and your master of disguise, et cetera.
Right. Maybe a big muscular, huge jacked man.
Exactly. Just huge thought. Jacked man. Yeah, to return to the previous to the
who was in
previous
that again?
Theme. Yeah, Scarlett Johansson, I think.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, one of the things that successful pitches do, in a sense, is say, we've got the team, right? We've got the chief, you know, resource officer. We've got sort of people and culture. We've got sort of this small crew that's willing to do it, but we need the leader. And what CEO doesn't secretly want to be Nicolas Cage stealing 50 cars?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a, or of that, you know, that turns it from, you know, kind of a, you know, an abstract, you know, business calculation into something for which they can really have sort of some passion and some dedication.
Right. Yeah. And it appeals to the ego, which is always.
Exactly.
You know, it's a great, great tool, obviously, when trying to motivate people.
Yeah. This can't happen without you,
but
it will change everyone's life if it does. Yeah.
And you can be like a local god, you know,
right,
in your mind, if you'd be so kind enough and benevolent.
That's right.
Well, I feel like we could keep talking about this for a long time with you, and we'll have to have you back on as you kind of continue to spread the word about this. But Dr. Alex Soojun King-Peng, it's such a pleasure having you on the show. Where can people find you, follow you, all that good stuff, read you? So,
right. So the 4-Day Week Global's website is 4dayweek.com, which is very convenient. And then my book, Rest, is available everywhere, you know, sort of books are sold, and also the place where books are sold online. And then my book about the 4-day week is called Shorter. And, you know, once again, that's out. And then I don't do a whole lot on social media these days because I'm sort of busy with another book project and lots of other stuff. But if you want to see like pictures of my dog on Instagram, I am AskPang, AskPang. And that's actually my handle on pretty much everything. So you can be part of that select circle of my 43 followers or so, sort of, on social media.
There you go.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. What kind of dog do you have? Just so we can chum the waters.
Little 15 pound spaniel who's about like 16 years old now. So,
Oh, wow. We love old spaniels, don't we, folks?
We do. We do love an old spaniel on this show.
Yeah, we do. We do.
We've had a couple of them. And is there a work of media that you've been enjoying?
A work of media that I've been enjoying.
Social or otherwise.
Social or otherwise. You know, watching, can I say, sort of a certain sort of Schadenfreude, sort of watching the dumpster fire of X, sort of that whole story, you know, just, you know, living in Silicon Valley and knowing a couple people who had been working at Twitter, sort of seeing what's been going on with that has been remarkable and kind of terrifying. In terms of, you know, any other media that I've been enjoying, I've been listening to a lot of Ryuichi Sakamoto, who was a, you know, composer. He was a founding member of Yellow Magic Orchestra and then went on and did lots of soundtracks and very experimental stuff. He just died a few months ago. So
yeah, March.
In March. But, you know, as an example of someone who was incredibly creative for an incredibly long time, he is sort of, I think, a real model for us all, right? The guy who could do, you know, bring electronic music to Japan, but also win an Oscar for, you know, his soundtrack work and collaborate with David Bowie, you know, sort of co-star in a movie with David Bowie.
Right.
You know, this guy was a baller. And so, sort of, you know, his work is so varied. There's something in it for everyone. So that's amazing.
That sounds great. And Miles, where can people find you? Is there a work of media you've been enjoying?
Oh, man. Find me on wherever they got the at thing. Shift, hit the shift key and then hit number 2 and then type in Miles of Gray, M-I-L-E-S. Ow, I just hit my knee on the desk. M-I-L-E-S-O-F-G-R-A-Y. And then also, if you like basketball, you can hear Jack and I on our basketball podcast, Miles and Jack Got Mad Boosties. And if you like 90 Day Fiancé, catch me on 420 Day Fiancé and also The Good Thief. That's so many shows. So just look for me and you'll find the
Never
podcast.
Stop
will
listening
follow.
To Miles's voice.
No, please. It's all I hear. Although help me get to Lambeau, please. I haven't seen my son in 5 months. Then that's by choice. That's by choice because I'm not done grinding.
Stay strong.
Yet. But
stay strong.
Alex has given me the courage to maybe shave off an hour or two of just looking at used Lambo ads. And to that, I owe you a debt of gratitude. Let's see. In terms of tweets or anything, I don't have anything on Twitter or Instagram that I've liked. Let's see. Did I see anything? No. I don't really have anything to suggest at the moment. Just, you know, let me know. Put me onto something. I need a new show. That's a murder mystery because that's the only thing Her Majesty, my partner, likes to watch with me. She won't watch comedy with me. So give me good and something with European people in. That always works. So hit me up.
Has to be European
people. I implore you. Got to be European people. She loves a good European people being all mean and murdery.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at Jack_O'Brien. Tweet I've been enjoying, David Hines tweeted me. So you just released The Exorcist Believer, Blumhouse. Yes, me. And you're calling the second one The Exorcist Deceiver, Blumhouse. Yes, me. My pitch is for the third one, Blumhouse. Oh no, me, extreme Air Bud guy voice. There's no rule that says a dog can't conduct an exorcism. The Exorcist Golden.
Golden Retriever,
maybe. Golden Believer. Well, you know, it's up to you guys. Whatever. That's what you guys are the creative ones. You're the ones who are allowed to take breaks, not us. You can find us on Twitter at Daily Zeitgeist. We're at The Daily Zeitgeist on Instagram. We have a Facebook fan page and a website, dailyzeitgeist.com, where we post our episodes and our footnotes, where we link off to the information that we talked about in today's episode, as well as a song that we think you might enjoy. Miles, is there a song that you think people might enjoy?
Yeah, I was just listening to this duo that I think they're from Atlanta. I heard them years ago, like where there was a track with Claro, like rapping on it with them. They're called Coco and Claire Claire. And they have a track called Outro. And it's like their music's just like fun DIY, like bedroom hip hop. and their like monotone flow is just always, I've always been a fan. So this is Outro by Coco and Claire Claire.
All right. Well, we will link off to that in the footnotes. The Daily Zeitgeist is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. That's going to do it for us this morning. Back this afternoon to tell you what is trending, and we will talk to y'all then. Bye.
Bye.
Here's something you might not know about wireless. Sometimes what you see isn't what you get. But with Visible, what you see is what you get. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 per month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.